Plant Online program here at thecommentary.ca. I'm joined now by acclaimed author and military historian Mark Zelke. He's the author of a new book, From Knopf for Honor's Sake, The War of 1812 and the Brokering of an Uneasy Peace. It was Canada's most famous war, yet it's not been fully appreciated due to the fact who won it has been a point of argument since the conflict ended. The author vividly recreates the war as never before, providing context to some of the countless legends that have come from the conflict, which pitted the British and the Americans, that saw the Canadians fight with the Indians, with the British, and Canadians burn down the White House. He also draws upon never-before-seen archival material, providing fresh insight and analysis that makes the book engrossing and fair. Mark Zelke's previous books include Ortona, The Leary Valley, and The Gothic Line, all lauded for their depiction of Canada's role in World War II, as well as Juno Beach and Holding Juno, both on the D-Day battle. For Honor's Sake, which the Globe and Mail said is authoritative and a convincing work, retails for $37.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Mark Zelke. Good morning, Mr. Zelke.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. Why a book on the War of 1812 now?
Well, when we started looking at the idea, I actually had that same kind of thought. The publisher actually approached me and said he was interested in having a book on the War of 1812, and my first reaction was, well, didn't Pierre Burton do that back with his two-volume work? Then I started looking at it, and what we started realizing was that the diplomatic story of the War of 1812 had never really been told at all, because the moment the war began, there was a great interest by both the British and the Americans to bring it to an immediate negotiated peace, because they both realized that it was possibly the wrong war at the wrong time. And as we started looking at that, also started seeing a lot of parallels between really what's going on today, particularly with regard to American involvement in Iraq and the motivations behind how they got into that quagmire, and what had happened in Canada with their decision to invade Canada in the beginning of the War of 1812. So we saw them an interesting parallel.
Now let's talk. Just pretend one knows nothing about the War of 1812. It's the British, the Americans actually want to come up to British North America, Canada, and annex that, right?
That's right, correct.
And then so the British come in and defend the Canadians. And my question was about that, was why did the Canadians and the Indians decide to fight with the British and resist American incursion?
I think the thing that was the fascinating thing is because actually the Americans particularly, they just thought that when they came into British North America that immediately the French Canadians particularly would throw their hand in with the Americans. There were an awful lot of Americans in Upper Canada at that point who had moved there to settle, largely because it was peaceful and they could get away from the Indian Wars that were a constant part of the American Western frontier. And so they were astonished when neither of those groups threw in with them. And the reasoning behind that, looking at the French Canadians first, was that they when the British conquered them, and conquered New France, they brought into place a very generous agreement with the French Canadian population, where they were allowed to keep many rights they had had under New France, and actually were given additional rights. So they didn't have any real grievance against the British. The Americans who had moved there to Ontario to settle, they had come in largely, as I mentioned, to get away from the Indian frontier wars, and they found that there was it was a very peaceful situation in Upper Canada. Also, the British government was basically giving them the land that they were then setting up for farming, and there were no taxes or anything like that. So again, an absence of any kind of grievance against the British. And as for the Indians, well, the situation there was that the Americans were constantly pushing westward into their traditional lands, and often doing so by basically massacring them as they got in their way. So the Indians, they viewed they weren't exactly massively happy to be engaged with the British either. They viewed them as the better of the two options, and so threw their lot in with the British.
The let's go back now to something you mentioned earlier, the parallels to today. I found that very interesting. You talk about that right at the top of the book, which is a great hook for someone like me who probably doesn't have a great appreciation of this conflict, but who follows current affairs.
Mm-hmm.
What's the parallels that you draw to today?
Once we really, that I really did notice as I was going along, is what you see when the Americans decide that they're going to declare war on Britain and do so by then invading Canada with the expectation that it will be an easy conquest, is very similar to what they did with Iraq. You have the decision to invade Iraq being based on, or justified by a number of claims, the weapons of mass destruction. On the War of 1812, the Americans claim that they are being mistreated by the British in a number of maritime issues, particularly in the impressment of their sailors off of ships into the British Navy, and a trade embargo that prohibits them from trading with France, because France and Britain are at war at that time. But the real motivation that becomes quite clear as you're doing the research is that the Americans, particularly the War Hawks, which were a group of politicians focused in Kentucky, Tennessee, and the other western states, have their eyes set on Canada. So you have the ostensible reasons for going to war, and then the reality of why you're going to war. And then you have the Americans having very little understanding of what it is they're getting themselves into. They didn't know much about British North America. They didn't do any advanced reconnaissance. They made these assumptions that French Canada and the American settlers in the Upper Canada area would just throw in their lot with them immediately upon arrival. And they discounted that the Indian Confederacy would rally to the way it did alongside the British. So they go into Canada expecting that it's going to be a complete cakewalk, and of course the reality is that they're met with significant resistance by the militias who were raised in Canada, and then they're supported by the Indian Confederacy and also the regular British Army.
We're talking to Mark Zelke, the author and historian who's written a new book, For Honor's Sake, The War of 1812 and the Brokering of an Uneasy Peace, 3795 from Knopf. Who won the War of 1812?
I think that it has to be said that Britain and Canada won, in that the American motivation and the reason they went to war was to conquer British North America and ultimately then control all of North America. They failed in that mission. They had to, they didn't achieve any of that. They actually lost a little bit of ground in the area of Maine. And so I think they did lose. They didn't lose by much, because in the negotiations they were able to negotiate basically a return to the status quo as it existed before the war. So they didn't really pay a price for having gone to war, other than, of course, the loss of thousands of people's lives and the burning of the Capitol and other losses that they suffered in that way.
Now, I did mention at the top there's a difference of opinion as to who won. Why is that? I guess if you go to the United States, they think they claim victory.
Yes, and there's a quirk in the whole thing is that most Americans, their real knowledge of the War of 1812 is focused on the Battle of New Orleans, which was actually fought in 1815, and almost 2 months after the treaty had been signed that brought the peace. But because of slow communications, everything happened to travel by sailing ship from Europe where the negotiations had been concluded. The Battle of New Orleans occurs before word can reach anyone. The Americans win that battle quite decisively, and the British had to withdraw from New Orleans. So based on that, the Americans, it's sort of like, well, it was the last battle, we won it, therefore we won the war.
There's this never-before-seen archive material that I mentioned up top. There's a letter from Wellington, and he's actually assisting the Americans in negotiating the Treaty of Ghent.
Yeah, this was an interesting diary by the son of one of the American negotiators. The son, James Gallatin, was a long acting personal secretary to his father, Albert Gallatin, who at that time was the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States government. Gallatin and Wellington had known each other socially before the war, and he received a letter from Wellington, who at this point is probably undoubtedly the most powerful individual figure in the British political system because of his victory over Napoleon. Wellington has been asked by the British government to go to Canada and take over command of the military there in order to effect a victory over the Americans, bring the war to a conclusion. He turns down that invitation and subsequently writes to Gallatin, informing him that he's done this and informing him that the British government is very desperate for a peace and therefore they should just get on with negotiating down to peace with confidence that the British will agree to the peace treaty. So it was an amazing little discovery. The letter is interesting because Wellington kept his dispatches very well organized, and I went through all of his dispatches, and the letter doesn't exist there, so he obviously suppressed it. Gallatin, when he receives the letter, his son sits down and begins to copy it out, as he did with all correspondence that came in, so that there was a second copy. He's about two paragraphs into it when Albert Gallatin comes in, reads the letter, and then takes the letters away from James and burns them in the nearby fireplace. So Gallatin and Wellington both, of course, realized that ultimately this was a fairly treasonous document, and they got rid of it. But then Gallatin was able to act on that intelligence.
So where did the son's transcription, where did you find that?
It was in a diary, his diary, which was published very obscurely in about 1905, and there's just a few copies of it kicking around. So I found the one copy in the archives in Ottawa.
Talk to me about some of the myths that have come up from this war. I guess the biggest Canadian one would be Laura Secord, the biggest American, probably the Star Spangled Banner, written, quickly by Francis Scott Key.
Yes. Well, the Star Spangled Banner one was written during the British had burned Washington, and they then proceeded up Chesapeake Bay to conquer Baltimore and burn it as well. That was the plan. They get to Baltimore, and there's a very prominent fort that dominates the entrance into the port, and so they were shelling the port particularly with incendiary rockets, and Keyes was actually an American who was on board one of the British ships. He'd come aboard in order to try and negotiate the release of an American doctor who had been taken into custody to work to treat American wounded or British wounded aboard the ships after they left Washington. So he's spent the night on one of these British ships, and he's watching the rockets flying over the fort, and it all seems very very awful, and they sure the fort's going to fall, but then in the morning, the American flag is still flapping on the pole above the fort, and he knows that they survived, and the siege was broke off shortly after that. So that became, he then wrote a poem, which became the Star Spangled Banner. I think it was in the late 1890s or something like that. It becomes actually the official American anthem. So that was the one. Laura Secord is a wonderful story, and remains wrapped in myth. We don't really know how that truly played out. Laura Secord warned the British officer, of course, that the Americans were marching from her village towards his position. She traveled across country, ostensibly to get there. Was picked up by the Indians who were camped in front of the British position and then taken to the officer, and she gives the warning. Well, that part definitely did occur, but what has never been able to be resolved is why she came into the information that the Americans were coming at all. In one account, she said it was because the American officer who was leading the force came to her house and insisted on being fed dinner. But in reality, he didn't get to the town until 2 days after that, and after she had left and given the warning to the British commander. So that couldn't have been. It seems the most likely account of all the various versions that I ran across is that she had a relative. There were a lot of cross-border relationships where Americans, because of the flow of Americans, and that she had a relative who was actually had been in the American force and had deserted and was passing through her village and as he was getting away from the American army, and he warned her, and she then went and took the information to the British general.
It's a fascinating story. I mean, we've grown up listening to variations of it. What's the reaction been to the book so far?
So far, very good. You know, it's interesting. I'm getting a lot of email from people who were saying how much they had learned about the War of 1812. I've had quite a number of responses from teachers in high school and early college level stuff who are definitely taking the book and incorporating it into their curriculum as a way of bringing the war to life, bringing the history to life. One of the problems and challenges for people teaching history in the schools is so much of what we have in the way of written historical material about things is very dry and very academic and not all that exciting for young people to read. So I, when I do my writing, I'm very mindful of the need to really make it part of the storytelling process. So I do a lot of research so that I can actually recreate the, you know, what was the weather like when that battle occurred, what was, you know, what did people say to each other if you're able to find that kind of thing. You know, really make it, bring it to light.
And it makes for very readable material. Did you think that it changes Canadians' perspective of the war? Do you find that the way it was taught in schools changes perhaps because of the discoveries that you've made or the way that you've presented what you've researched?
I think probably it is, particularly in the sense of understanding how the negotiated peace that came out of the War of 1812 set the ground for, really set the framework for what then it became, would evolve into Canada becoming a nation. Because as part of the negotiations with the Americans, they didn't give in to a lot of things that the Americans wanted, like restrictions on the way Canada was able to trade with the Indians west of them. The boundary for the 49th parallel is basically set in place during that treaty. The factor that the border that the Americans would not have a military presence of great strength on the Great Lakes. So it precluded the chance, or at least much diminished the chance, of a war in the future. And with the participation of the Canadian militias, particularly the French Canadian militias, in fighting off the Americans, there became an identity, the beginning of an identity of what we were as Canadians. And it was kind of an interesting identity because I think initially it's just more, we're Canadians because we're not Americans. But then it starts to evolve through the rest of the mid-1800s to something that by the time we get to Confederation, we have a sense of ourselves as a nation that has a linkage to Britain and British custom.
One of the things that I've been reading in the reviews of the book, they mentioned the Pierre Burton books. They also compare your writing style to that Margaret Macmillan used in Paris 1919. For those two historians in particular, what inspiration did you take from their work?
Pierre Burton has always inspired me because he was the first Canadian historian, writer of popular history, who really turned history into bringing history alive through the process of storytelling narrative. Up until Pierre Burton started writing in the 50s, Canadian history had been very much in the hands of academic writers, and the academic writers were mostly writing back and forth to each other to prove theses that they had about different aspects of Canadian history. So Pierre Burton comes along and he just takes the entire history of Canada out of that closet of academia and presents it to the general public. And I was very much inspired by that, and really, you know, most of us who are writing the popular history that has a strong narrative thread in it are following in his footsteps. With Margaret Macmillan, you know, it was her decision with Paris 1919 that the machinations of a very complex negotiation could be turned into something that could be a page-turning book, was really gave me the confidence when I started going down the road of doing exactly that with the Treaty of Ghent negotiations, to know that it would actually work.
This is, as I said up top, it's a highly readable book, and congratulations for it, and thanks for joining us today, and continued success with it, Mark.
Thank you, Joseph.
The book is called For Honor's Sake, The War of 1812,